So I concocted this test flight. And so what we did is we covered up the windows, took some little light cardboard or some Velcro to cover the windows and the plexiglass or the canopy so it's dark. And then we had some cords hooked onto those things, and Gina had it in a bundle. And if I screamed, she could jerk it and pull those things off, and then I could reacquire the wingtips, and then I could see them. And this is a big test, because if I had to see those, now we're really in trouble for a lot of reasons. And so I'll never forget that day. We went out, now we're there at Bakersfield, and the air was really calm. We're flying along, it's nice and calm, and we had the chase pilots up there. And so then I kicked it off autopilot and started hand-flying the airplane. Terrible adverse yaw, I mean, just really atrocious flying quality. If you wanted to maneuver, but if you, yeah, I kept complaining to Bert. I says, hey, this thing is really terrible. And, you know, we try to turn it and it loses altitude. I mean, it's terrible. And he says, shut up, Dick. It's a world flight that doesn't have to turn at all. Anyway, that takes care of this. So we went out that day and I'm hand flying it. And we got it on autopilot and it's working really fine. And I'm doing the pitch oscillations and I can see this. And I turn the autopilot back on and we covered up the windows. And I thought, because now this thing will self-destruct in about 15 seconds, about 4 or 5 oscillations, and we'll fail it structurally. So we put the windows on. Now it's all dark inside the cockpit, can't see outside. The moment of truth. So we flew it around a little bit on autopilot, and I said, okay, guys, I'm going to kick the autopilot off and start hand flying. And hand flying makes some real gentle turns. I said, yeah, that's pretty good, I can do that. And so then, I wonder if I can recover from the pitch damping. And so I just gingerly let go of the stick and it flew about 2 or 3 seconds, took a little nibble and a bigger nibble and a bigger nibble. And this is it, baby. This is the big moment. Big nibble, and I grabbed the stick and dampened it out. And we pulled the window things off and he says, okay, I can fly this puppy at night. Let's take it home, the beer's on me.
I need to tell a story that's almost never told, because Dick does all the Voyager talks and I do all the spaceship talks. On the first flight of Voyager, when it was real light, and it we had, you know, just a tiny bit of fuel, about the amount that you put in your car. Dick came back and he says, that's one of the most beautiful flying airplanes I've ever flown. He says, it damps out really good, it's responsive. Yeah, it has some adverse yaw, but man, it's a lot better than I thought it could ever be. And then I went back to work on a Starship and we didn't talk for a long time. And then when I went down there and see how it flew when we put a hell of a lot of weight in it. And of course it's best if you put fuel in it to put it in the wingtips, okay? If you put fuel just only in the insides, you can make it worse. That's why the Voyager used the fuel out of the inside and working out and used the tips last. The airplane got stronger in a gust and stronger to take G's if you take fuel out. That's why we thought it would be after maybe a day, so that the airplane, if it had actually we thought that after a day or so, even Gina could fly it. But as it turns out, the airplane was not flyable without this fatigue or the autopilot working perfect until about 2.5 days into the flight, where most of the fuel is gone. 2.5 days in the flight, most of the fuel is gone. 9-day flight. But I tell you, if you were there watching Voyager when it was flying, especially when it was flying light at Mojave, it reminded you kind of like a sailboat or kind of something that was floating. It had 111-foot wingspan and a stall speed of, I don't know, 34 knots or so at light weight, and it just floated on the air. And you never saw that.
I never saw that.
He's the only one that never saw a Voyager flight.
Never saw that.
But it was a thrill for us to watch it fly around the airport. And really a neat thrill for me, because after the flight, he did another flight to get some photography. You know, he forced the flapping of the wings, and on one of the films, you see the wings doing this, and you're up close. That was actually after the Voyager flight, and taken from a chase plane. And they had a lot of fun. Knowing it's going to be the last flight, he did what I did with a very big one when I delivered it to the EAA Museum in what's the town down there? Hale's Corners, a little airport. I knew this airplane would never fly again, and I just beat up the field. High speed passes, full aft stick. I just had all kinds of fun. Okay, Voyager, what was it, 3 or 4 days after the flight, after you got some rest, you decided to fly days. That last flight again?
10 days, I think.
10 days. Okay. When he came back, I think he had the same kind of feeling that I did, knowing that the very Vigan would never fly again. He beat up the field. Real low gear up passes. Some of the coolest shots of the Voyager flying around Mojave was Dick, as a fighter pilot,
right down the ramp,
having a lot of fun, coming right down in front of us, not over the runway, having fun flying the Voyager, knowing that it probably is not going to kill him now, and knowing that it's never going to fly again. That was kind of fun.
That's right. That was, I looked around and I says, here's my big chance to do something illegal. And there's nobody going to frown at me about that. Hey, there was one thing about this thing. This airplane was in flight test for 2.5 years. For 2.5 years, we did nothing else. We get up and did a flight test. And we always had problems, and we'd write up the problems, whether it's a cockpit fire or some other avionics things that we had, or a propeller blade came off. And we were going through the thing about this, 2.5 years of intensive flight test. We take off, we land, there's always a whole bunch of gigs. We down, we have a debrief, we talk to Bert, he figures out what we're gonna change to fix whatever the problem was, and go back and test it again. I got out of the airplane after laying down for 9 days, and I tried to get down the ladder and my legs wouldn't work. And I looked at all the TV cameras out there and I thought, there is no fine way they're gonna carry this fighter pilot off this airplane. So I sat on the side of the airplane and I was working my legs and stuff. And finally, I thought it was strong enough to hold my weight, and it was just barely.
He said, I'm going to sit here for a while.
Because I didn't want anybody to know that I couldn't walk. Anyway, one thing that really surprised me, and I realized that after a week and a half with no bath, I wasn't going to have to worry about anybody hugging me. But the only time I can remember that when I got down and sapped it up, Brother Bert come up and give me a big hug. Yeah. And that's really brave, because I can only imagine. Because I can only imagine what we smelled like. Now, the next thing that happened, the first thing that Bert did, he got his pad and pencil out, and he was going around and he was counting the number.
No, that was NASA doing that, not me. I didn't give a shit.
You didn't, you were doing
NASA. NASA engineers.
I saw you doing that.
I was watching them.
Oh, okay.
NASA engineers approached that airplane before anybody touched it and documented every insect strike on the wings, because they wanted to see how much laminar flow helped it go around the world, and they wanted to see how much laminar flow might still exist after flying for 9 days. And they wrote a report that tells where every bug landed.
Gina, on the 4.5 day warm-up flight where we broke the B-52 record, but just by a little bit, after that flight, Gina had passed out right in front of the TV cameras because of dehydration, and we learned a lot about human factors and Maslow's order and some other stuff, and I'll talk about that in the museum. But they wanted to get me in the museum, and the doctors couldn't wait to get their hands on both of us. But anyways, Susie Bowman had Gina, and I don't even think she was touching the ground, and took her, and she drove off in the ambulance. And they wanted me, and I says, hey, I've been flying this thing. This is the 69th flight on the Voyager. And I'm going to do everything that I did on all those other flights. post-flight. Wow, look how close we came. What, a quarter of an inch, the rupture in that outboard cell?
Actually, an interesting part of that story is the Voyager was built with fuel going all the way to the wingtips. Okay? We knew we'd have to put winglets on it so we could get the fuel vents high enough so when it sank like this, it wouldn't pump fuel out the, or drain fuel out of the, yep, out of the vents. We put them high. Not needed when the wings are like this, of course. Okay, the first time we weighed the airplane when it was mostly complete, I calculated that the airplane was tail heavy. So instead of putting nose weight in it, imagine me going and bolting some lead in it after not letting him put a fuel valve in it, right? What I did to make it with a proper static margin, I made the back wing longer. And to make it simple, the outer 4 feet of the Voyager was just like a Longy's. It was a hot-wired core of styrofoam with a single ply of carbon fiber over it to hold the winglet. So when it scraped for a mile and a half on the runways, it scraped all the way down, but not into the fuel tank.